Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang with another installment of Fight the Empire. And our guest is Ray McGovern, who's a former CIA analyst and author of several articles. He's one of the founders of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And he has written a recent article in the Consortium News, which is a very interesting website, a lot of good articles there, Consortium News, and it's all about the headline is Obama's Timidity and Deaths at Sea. So, Ray McGovern, are you there? Well, he's not there yet, but pretty soon. Anyway, he's got this article. It's in the consortiumnews.com. And, okay, Ray McGovern, are you there?
I am.
Oh, welcome to KBOO.
Can you hear me okay?
I hear you fine. And, you know, reading your article in Consortium News about the sort of interplay between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, I kind of wonder who has got who on the leash?
Well, I hate to say it, but we have the Israeli tail wagging the Obama dog here. And it all has to do with longstanding U.S. domestic politics, where people don't win elections unless they show themselves to be 110% behind Israel, no matter what Israel does.
Well, this allows Israel to do almost anything then, doesn't it?
Well, witness what happened Sunday evening and Monday morning. Netanyahu, as you may know, was in Canada at the time, and he was due Tuesday in the White House for a kiss-and-make-up session, so-called, with President Obama. And initially, I had real problems trying to discern why it was that Netanyahu would have approved this kind of brigandage on the high seas, knowing that he was going to be meeting with the president the next day, really, because the incident happened Sunday night, early Monday morning. And I thought to myself, well, maybe he was mousetrapped by people even more extremist than Netanyahu in his government. And there are same, although that's hard to believe, but there are more extreme elements like his foreign minister, Lieberman, and others. But now it seems to me what I've come down to concluding is that, you know, this was to be one of those little Israeli raids where they were come on board, and they would be photographed, and it would be a lesson for the world, and the commandos would be received with great praise, as they were, even though they messed up. And Netanyahu would be walking into the White House on Tuesday morning, swinging, feeling really great about how his own forces had taken care of this terrible, terrible menace of 700 humanitarian workers on six ships. It didn't work out that way. And I dare say now that Israel is in real trouble, and it's up to Obama to decide whether he wants to go down with Israel in the international opprobrium that is justly directed at Israel's way, or whether he's going to come to his senses and risk losing some of the money and some of the publicity that the Likud lobby in this country and its influence in the what I call the phoning corporate press, the media, and the body politic at large. People usually don't win elections if they show themselves to be any less, as I said before, any less than 110% behind Israel, no matter what it does. So he's got a tough calculation, and he hasn't shown himself very, very courageous so far. Mm-hmm. And I would just quote Thomas Aquinas, who said that courage is the precondition of all virtue.
Well,
so if he's got no guts, he's not going to do the right thing.
Well, if you were a betting man, would you? which side would you come down on?
I think he's going to cave, just mm-hmm. as he always has, and therein lies a real, real danger. Because if I were Netanyahu, And the president warned me in the strongest terms not to build any more settlements in East Jerusalem or the West Bank. And I thumbed my nose at him. And when Joe Biden came to visit, my housing minister announced that indeed they were building 1,600 more housing units in East Jerusalem. And what happened? Zippo. Nothing. Oh, yeah, Joe Biden, he did a courageous thing. He was late for dinner with Netanyahu. He kept him waiting for something like 3 or 4 hours. Wow, is that a strong reaction?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what did Barack Obama do when Netanyahu visited Barack Obama the next month? Whoa, tough guy. You know what he did? He didn't invite him to dinner. Instead, Barack Obama went to dinner with his wife and family. Wow, and a terrible diplomatic snub. Netanyahu and the Likud extremists are laughing up their sleeves. They look at Obama as, well, in the Bronx we would call it a wuss. You know, he's a real wuss without much backbone. And the reason I mentioned that this is a great danger is because if Netanyahu and the people that really seem out of control there in the Israeli government, if they take it into their heads to attack Iran or to cause the kind of provocation in the Gulf, for example, and I understand that they have 3 cruise missile submarines now in the Gulf, if they do a provocation which ends up in war, or let's say the scenario that most people would expect Israel to follow, would be to send their fighter bombers and other aircraft across Iraqi airspace to get to Iran. That's the only way they can get there and back without refueling. Now, who controls Iraqi airspace? The United States of America does, at least for the next couple of months. Do you think that Netanyahu, looking at the situation and looking at the continual backdowns by our president, do you think that he would judge that our president would order his armed forces to shoot down Israeli aircraft? Give me a break. No way would he conclude that Obama would do that. So if Netanyahu has the same impression of Obama that I think he does, we are in real trouble, because those people in Tel Aviv are not very reliable. They're unpredictable now. Witness what they did on Sunday evening, Monday morning.
Well, let me put forth a possible defense for Obama, and then you can shoot it down if you want.
Sure.
This goes back to JFK, when he was faced with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who were just as sort of mad dog as the Israel lobby. And in the book Brothers by David Talbot, he goes in a lot of detail how JFK had to find backdoor ways to communicate with Castro and Khrushchev, and he had to kind of play along with the Joint Chiefs and throw them a little meat now and then. And although he had his just to kind of back away from the Cold War a little bit, do you think Obama might be in a similar situation?
Well, that's a really good point. He is in a similar situation. And Talbot's book is good, but there's an even better one, and I would like your listeners to know about it. It's called JFK and the Unspeakable.
Ah, yes, I'm reading it now.
Are you? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the author is James Douglas, with two S's on the end there, and he has done the most meticulous study, the first third of which is devoted to precisely what you were alluding to, the bad odor that JFK found himself in with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with the CIA, with the Secret Service, and with the FBI. And I never thought I would hear myself saying these things, but Douglas makes a very, very persuasive case that it was this kind of cabal that was responsible for the killing of our president, and for untold misery in its wake. He was about to get out of Vietnam. He had already ordered 1,000 troops home, and the rest of the troops, or as it was put in the executive order, the bulk of the rest of the troops by the end of the following year. He was talking with Khrushchev without anyone from the FBI listening in. He had shown himself reluctant to obliterate Cuba, which the Joint Chiefs, as you point out, the really rabid Joint Chiefs wanted him to do. And so he was looked on as a real danger to our security. After all, you know, pulling out of Vietnam, didn't he know that the domino effect, we would lose all of Southeast Asia and Indonesia and the Philippines and the whole rest of it? Didn't he know that the Russians would come down in there and take? You know, it was all poppycock. It was all cockamamie stuff. And yet they believed it. And as I say, Douglas makes a very good case that's what did JFK in. And with reference to Obama's situation, I hesitate to think of myself saying this, but I am convinced that Obama is afraid of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And I use as evidence for that the fact that when he took over, he took steps to exculpate, to excuse, to ignore, to not press charges against any of the folks that were responsible for the torture, for the kidnapping, for putting the people in black holes without telling their wives or children, much less the Red Cross. All those people, guess what? They weren't given other jobs. They weren't retired early. They are still running the place.
Right.
Panetta came in just, he's acting as the CIA lawyer. He's not directing the place. The folks that were responsible for this are still there. And John Brennan, one of the worst, you know, who bragged on NPR that, extraordinary rendition really wasn't kidnapping, you know, it was necessary to get all these terrorists and stuff. Well, he couldn't make it as the head of the CIA. So they gave him the most important national security post in the National Security Council, and that is the guru over all terrorism. He's supposed to coordinate all anti-terrorist activity, and he's doing a bang-up job, isn't he, with Abdul Muttalib and that fellow that killed the seven CIA employees in eastern Afghanistan, and the Hassan who shot up our soldiers there at the base in the Midwest. Yeah, you not only have people who have no moral compass, but you have people who got to their positions by saluting smartly when people like Bill Casey and people like Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz said jump, they jumped real high. And so you have that kind of folks in there. And, you know, they are in charge of about 200,000 mercenaries, Blackwater, and all the others that are in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what happens if those wars are wound down and those mercenaries come home? They're highly trained. They're special forces type or, you know, the Navy equivalent. And where are they going to find work? Well, they're going to work for whoever it was that hired in the first place, the Dick Cheneys of this world. And so, you know, does Obama have reason to be afraid of the CIA? Unfortunately, I think he does. And I think he missed a big chance to clean up that place when he came into office. And now he's behind the eight ball, both with respect to the CIA and to the Defense Department run by a fellow who used to work for me, Robert Gates. And, you know, this business about a team of rivals, well, he's made it possible for these rivals to undermine him at almost every turn. And the most recent example of that is the tripartite agreement worked out by Turkey and Brazil with Iran, where Obama himself sent letters. We have the text of the letters now to the Brazilian president, to the Turkish prime minister, saying, please, if you could work out this deal with Iran, it would be great because it would be a great confidence-building measure. Now, they worked it out. Guess what? The next day, Hillary Clinton gets up and says, this is our answer to that tripartite deal. We're going to go ahead with sanctions. We got everybody on board, Russia, China, and everyone. We're going to really put in tough sanctions against Iran. Whoa, wait a minute. The Brazilian president and the Turkish prime minister were, after they recovered, they were saying, well, wait a second. This is what your president asked us to do. What's going on here? Well, what's going on there is very easy to cipher. Neither Israel, despite all its rhetoric, nor the United States, despite its rhetoric, are really afraid of the low-enriched uranium in Iran. Witness the fact that that tripartite agreement provides for half of it, half of that low-enriched uranium to go out of country to Turkey in the first instance, and then on to Russia to be refined into the kind of uranium they need to run their medical reactor. So, you know, if Israel and the U.S. were really concerned about Iran building a nuclear weapon, well, you know, they should be standing up, clapping, and saying, "Great, great, Brazil, great, Turkey, nice deal. At least half of the threat is gone, and we'll watch the other half." Okay. Instead of that, they belittle the deal. They call the Brazilian president and the Turkish prime minister naive, being sucked into this deal by the Iranians, crafty as they are, and they're going to go ahead with sanctions. Now, how do you explain that? How do you explain it? Well, the explanation is that Israel doesn't care very much about the uranium in Iran. What they want is regime change. What they want is to get rid of the mullahs and the people and the dog that are being wagged by the Israeli tail have fallen to line, and you have the Hillary Clintons, you have the Rahm Emanuel, White House chief of staff, mind you. Now, you know, he has dual citizenship. He's both an Israeli citizen, and I'll say this to his credit, that Rahm Emanuel, as soon as the balloon went up in the first Gulf War there in 1991, well, he immediately, you know, worked for the army. Most people don't realize that it was the Israeli army that he felt he needed to work for. So that's what we have in the White House. You have Dennis Ross in the National Security Council, who is a rabid Zionist. And so, you know, Obama is up against it. He writes this letter to those two chiefs of state, and they do what he tells them, and then they're shocked when his foreign secretary or secretary of state and all the rest of it there pour scorn on the deal that they worked out. So there's another example of how Obama is really not in control, just as Netanyahu may not be in fully control, because I think that maybe he's beholden to the same kind of extremists that Obama faced is right here in Washington.
Well, I wonder about Israel. You know, there's something about Israel's actions in the last, I don't know, number of years that really kind of gives hint at some sort of desperation. And you mentioned in your article that that Israel refuses to define its borders. And so let me run this by you, that maybe the reason for that is that they still have dreams of expanding, and expanding requires the removal of the Palestinians. But the Palestinians are digging in, and they're not going to move. And so, demographics is just kind of pointing towards a one-state solution, and that Israel is sort of has no other way out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a very good point. I agree with it. There's one other element here that is new and very, very important. You know, when the Israelis blow out of all proportion the Iranian threat, the fact that, it could make a nuclear weapon, even though the intelligence folks, excuse me just for a second, a little drink of water there, even though our intelligence estimate says that Iran stopped working on the nuclear warhead aspects of its program in the fall of 2003, okay, now, that's almost 7 years ago, and has not resumed work on that. Anyhow, the Israelis are blowing up the threat, so-called, from Iran. Now, what's the effect of that? Well, one effect is to make the Iranians work even harder on whatever they're doing in nuclear-related stuff. But another effect is to scare the daylights out of young Israelis. And, you know, a lot of the young Israelis that have moved into the country, been recruited from abroad, they're highly proficient. They're big technical people. They keep the economy going. And guess what? They're leaving. Why should we live under this perpetual threat from Iran? So even though the threat has been manufactured, sort of synthetic, blown out of proportion, it's having an effect on the people that were not really the targets here. And so for the first time in Israel's existence, it's losing very highly qualified people who can find jobs in Western Europe or the United States. And what it's getting in as a substitute are people who are very low-skilled, people who are extremely right-wing, people who come to Israel from the Catskills or from Brooklyn or the Bronx because they get free housing in the West Bank. That's not the kind of folks that can make an economy go. And so, you know, when you talk about an existential threat, well, I would submit that Iran is not an existential threat to Israel, at least not now, but it can be used as an existential threat. And the rhetoric that uses it that way has quite ironically led to a brain drain in Israel. And for the first time, as I say, they're losing more people than they're gaining. And as everyone knows, Israel depends on a steady stream of immigration and really fears emigration. So they're in a bad position. And the worst of it is that they're acting very erratically. And there really seem to be taking on the whole world with this latest incident. Now, you can take on the whole world just long enough. If your ally is the strongest country in the world, well, you can get away with that probably for another few years. But I really fear for the future of Israel, because if they don't come to their senses, they're not going to be able to do the kinds of things that they've done up till now. They'll be hunkered down into an even more restrictive, secretive state, and they're not going to last long because of the dynamics and demographics that you mentioned just a little while ago.
Well, I wonder how Israel will deal with expensive oil whenever it happens.
Well, yeah, you know,
they need oil to make their military machine operate.
Yeah, they're in it just like the rest of us. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're closer to oil, and there are some pipelines that could help them. They're not as badly off as we are. I don't know if your listeners know how much it costs to deliver a gallon of gasoline to our troops in Afghanistan.
Oh, a lot,
one
yes.
Gallon? Mm-hmm. $400.
Wow.
$400 a gallon. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my beefs about Afghanistan. You know, as an old infantry officer, what's really important in this kind of operation are your lines of communication and supply. You can't get to Afghanistan from here, you know? Mm-hmm. You've got to either go through the Khyber Pass, which they're pretty much stopped doing because of the convoy getting blown up, or you go through, quote, friendly, end quote, countries like Kyrgyzstan or Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan or the Soviet Union, or, in the last resort, Iran. Give me a break. If I were a military commander and I realized that I would have to rely on supply lines like that, I would tell the president, Mr. President, this is a feckless exercise for lots of reasons. But you know, if I can't resupply my troops or even rotate them as they should be, you know, from a military point of view, it's a fool's errand.
Do you think the Israelis have any real notion of what a war with Iran would entail? I mean, I've heard about, you know, war games, including the Israelis, where all the outcomes are bad from their point of view.
Well, that's the way we see it, and that's the way I would suggest most reasonable people see it. General or Admiral Mullen, our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, he's clearly very worried about what the Israelis might do. Every time he goes to Israel, he says there, and he says when he comes back, it will be very, 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 three verys, okay? Very, very, very bad for hostilities to break out with Iran. Why does he say that? Because it's a no-win situation. What they can do, well, there are a number of things they can do, including mess it up for U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the first thing they would do, in my view, would be to close the Strait of Hormuz. to which comes, I think, about a third of the internationally traded oil. That would be a blow that the economies could hardly sustain. Now, when Mullen was, interestingly enough, when Mullen was asked about that, can Iran take the Strait of Hormuz? Oh, he's an honest guy, you know. He's a military. He says, well, yes. Well, we could take it right back. Well, right. Take a look at those cliffs. What are we going to do, send the Marines up those cliffs like Normandy? Are we going to helicopter them in like the Israelis do onto unarmed boats? Give me a break. Where are you going to get the Marines from? They're all in Afghanistan. So Mullen is clearly more worried now than he was even when Dick Cheney was, and he's since admitted this, very much pushing for war with Iran, because Mullen knows that if he were to be given an order to mop up after what the Israelis have done in Iran, that would cause all kinds of trouble for his troops, all kinds of terrorist activity around the world.
Do you think Obama's hearing this from Admiral Mullen, or what?
Well, he's hearing it, but, he's a political guy, and, he doesn't want to be in a position of giving anything less than 110% support for Israel. Therefore, he ignores what the intelligence people are saying. Witness the fact that if you listen to Obama, you get the idea that the Iranians are working real hard on a nuclear weapon, which they're not, according to intelligence. So, whether he listens or not, it's sort of like the B-52 example I had used before. When leaders like that are in a political bind, they believe what they want to believe. In that case, LBJ wanted to believe that these B-52s could seal off the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Okay, completely unrealistic. There was no Ho Chi Minh Trail, and we told them that. Doesn't look anything like I-5 or I-95 or anything like that. The 225 trails through the forest under a heavy canopy. You can't even see it from most of the way, okay? So we told Johnson this is a feckless exercise. Well, what it'll do is simply harden the resistance in the north and in the south. Now, I think he believed this, but he wanted to believe these blue-suited generals who told him, oh, these B-52s, let's show you how big a bomb that can drop. Blow them to smithereens. We'll seal off that Ho Chi Minh Trail. And so Johnson said, well, maybe the CIA and all these intelligence people are wrong. Maybe the Air Force, what's the alternative? Lose a war. I don't lose a war.
And look where it got them. I'm afraid we're at the end of our time. That's quite a place to end this show is the example of LBJ. But we've been talking with Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst, still analyzing events in the world, and author of an interesting article in Consortium News. So thank you very much for being with us.
You're most welcome.
And I hope we'll talk again some more as this unwinds. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.